From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, we'll explore some major issues affecting our state. The Trump administration has talked about U.S. energy self-sufficiency and energy dominance. We'll chat with a national expert on the topic. He recently visited Raleigh to analyze what energy dominance might actually mean. Members of the University of North Carolina's Board of Governors want to put the brakes on student tuition and fees. You'll hear them debate the issue. If you haven't heard much about good news linked to North Carolina's economy in recent years, you will through a campaign called NC Real Solutions. Find out who's leading the effort to tout the Tar Heel State's recent success. And we'll learn why the Town Council of Carolina Beach is earning kudos from a limited government watchdog. Those topics are just ahead. First, the Carolina Journal headline. SAT scores are up among North Carolina high school students. More of them are taking and passing advanced placement courses. That's great news, right? Well, our next guest is here to tell us. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research and Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you.
So we have heard trumpeted in headlines the fact that North Carolina high school students are seeing higher SAT scores and the numbers are looking better for AP classes and AP tests as well. Is this unqualified good news?
Well, it's definitely not unqualified. If you look at the test scores, you see some positive signs of improvement, but you also see some things that you know need to be addressed. And first and foremost, you look at the AP, the advanced placement pass rates are still just a hair over 50%. So that means around half of the students and half of the tests that they take for an advanced placement course, they're not passing. And that should be something that we need to worry about considering that we're placing increased investment in AP courses.
So signs of improvement, but still a long way to go for AP.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as the SAT goes, this is an interesting one because North Carolina students have been actually in fewer numbers taking the SATs because the state pays for all 11th graders to take the ACT test. So we're seeing fewer students take the SAT, and our combined score was higher than the national average. It was 1074. On a revised test, and this is really important because it makes it difficult to compare North Carolina to previous administrations of the test. Instead, we have to just deal with the fact that the College Board that created the SAT and continues to administer it created a new test, and North Carolina students seem to be doing well, but fewer of them are taking that test.
In addition to the change in the test, wouldn't we see some changes in the scores just from the other factors that you mentioned, the fact that fewer students are taking the test and thus more likely they're the ones who are better students who need the SAT to get into certain schools?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, it really does beg the question of why a student, if they're having the ACT paid for, which is also a college admission exam, would choose to take the SAT. And maybe the SAT tests different strengths than the ACT. And so that's why students are increasingly using the SAT and using the ACT and also taking the SAT. But whatever the case is, we would probably see an increase of scores because of the fewer students taking it. That's definitely going to be one factor. And the other factor may be changes in the test itself. It could be that students have stronger skills given the changes in the test than they did in the previous tests.
We are chatting with Dr. Terry Stoops, who is Vice President for Research at the John Locke Foundation. You also referenced the fact that students are pretty much all taking the ACT. What are we seeing in terms of the numbers for that test?
Well, we're seeing some improvements, but there is one alarming number, and that number is 11.5%. And that represents the percentage of students that are career and college ready across the four subjects that the ACT tests. That would be reading, writing, math, and science. So really, only a very small segment of the student population is really ready for college and career, just a hair over 10% of our students. The rest of them have mixed success with the testing, with the ACT testing. We see some better scores in some subjects compared to others. But still, the percentage of students that are proficient in those four areas are really what we need to zoom in on when we look at the ACT scores.
Is that a real sign of alarm? I mean, is North Carolina standing out from the pack in terms of not having many students who are competent, I guess is the correct word to say, in all of those subject areas?
We're definitely not unique, but here's the interesting aspect of that. Our graduation rate continues to go up. And because our graduation rate continues to increase, the assumption is that the graduates that we're putting out there are ready for higher education or ready for the job market. But unfortunately, the ACT scores indicate that that's not the case. And in fact, interestingly enough, we can also see in the SAT score, they are gauging college readiness as well. They found a little more optimistic of a number that just about half of the students who took the SAT are career and college ready. But as we mentioned earlier, those are probably the better students. So we would suspect that they're going to be career and college ready. But the ACT scores represent all the 11th graders in North Carolina.
For years and years, people have looked at the SAT and North Carolina's SAT score as sort of the benchmark of how high school students are doing. But as someone who has looked through the numbers, knows the details of who's taking what test, among those tests, SAT, ACT, AP, or if there are others, what are the ones that people really should be paying attention to?
Well, definitely the ACT, because it represents all 11th graders in North Carolina. The SAT is problematic because of the changes in the participation rate. If they continue to decline, which they probably will, then we'll get less of a sense of really where North Carolina students are at. And AP is an interesting one because if our goal and the legislature, it does have a goal of getting more students in advanced placement courses, having those students successfully complete those courses is very important. So we need to pay attention to the percentage of students that score a 3 or higher. That's the guideline on these AP tests. But I think looking at these 11th graders taking the ACT test is probably the thing we should focus on the most.
Is there anything among those scores that points to some type of change that ought to be made at the high school level or even earlier? I mean, do you look at them and say, aha, if we did this in 10th grade or we did this back in the 6th or 7th grade, we would see better scores?
If I had those answers, I'd probably be a billionaire. But the truth of the matter is we do need to start early. And the legislature has been looking at early grade reading, grades K through 3, Read to Achieve program. Because one thing we do know is that if you're not proficient in reading by the third grade, then you're going to fall further and further behind as you progress through middle and high school, and you end up struggling. And so we need to continue to focus on K-3, especially reading, because it's so important to all the other subject areas. And I think the legislature is on the right track with making sure that all third graders are proficient in reading.
It sounds as if one piece of advice you would give to policymakers is don't pat yourselves on the back or pat the public school officials on the back for these recent improvements, because there's still a lot of work to be done.
That's right. And fortunately, we saw that the press release that was published by the Department of Public Instruction actually said that. They actually said there's a lot more work to do. There's some signs of progress, but a lot more work to do. And so they know and realize that in the past, we had a lot of pomp and circumstance with the slightest increase in test scores. Now we sort of have a more reality-based approach to testing in North Carolina and what it tells us.
In the brief amount of time that we have left, are you going to be looking next year most at what happens with that ACT score?
Yes. Most important for this year, though, is the National Assessment of Education Progress, which should be released in the next month or two. And this is a national test that a sample of North Carolina students take every other year. We're going to get the results from the 2017 administration of math and reading for grades 4 and 8. This is a very important test. Really gives us the comparison of North Carolina to other states and will give us a trend that we can see how North Carolina has been doing through the years.
We know one person who's going to be looking at those numbers very closely is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research and also Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The Trump administration has talked about world energy dominance. Well, what would that mean, and how might it impact the nation's strategic defense? Our next guest has spent time thinking about that topic. He recently shared his thoughts with the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Dr. Daniel Fine is Associate Director of the New Mexico Center for Energy Policy. He is also Senior Policy Analyst for the New Mexico State Department of Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So this has been something that's been in the news because of President Trump talking about energy and trying to make the United States a dominant energy producer. As someone who works in the field of energy, what does energy dominance mean to you?
It means that the United States has reversed a dependency policy, which dominated 1973 to the present. All our defense and certainly energy policies from four administrations was based on the need to import foreign oil to the United States. Dependency was based on the cutoff, the disruption, mainly from the Middle East and OPEC, Saudi Arabia. What the administration, the Trump administration, has done is reversed that. The new policy is to either look at dominance or self-sufficiency.
Sounds like a massive change.
Yeah. I prefer self-sufficiency. That means the revolution in shale production in 06 developed a capacity to go to the source rock. It upended historic geology. It reversed the way oil is basically explored for and produced. This technology revolution in extracting oil in the United States has changed not only the Trump administration, but the dynamic of the world. It had caused, for example, a reaction by Saudi Arabia and OPEC in 2014. They understood that the main threat to their world market in oil was from the United States, the Southwest, and North Dakota. This change still exists. in spite of a price war of 2.5 years and market share conflict. The capacity given financial borrowing, lending to support the technology is moving the United States probably within 3 years of over 10 million barrels a day of oil. Oil dominance means essentially through Secretary Zinke of the Interior Department, a capacity now to become self-reliant in oil without importing, or at least the dependency on imports. And this meant for Zinke, Secretary Zinke, the opening up of federal land. And that is a classic change in American foreign policy, domestic oil policy. It influences foreign policy. The federal government is going to open federal land to expedite leasing of it for oil and gas. This is a reversal completely of the Obama administration, which followed not an energy policy, but in fact an energy rejection in favor of climate change. It was a climate change policy, subset energy. That has been reversed by executive order and by the new overall policy, releasing federal land, as it is in law, to rapid permitting and leasing. For example, Secretary Zinke said it's the average time it has taken under the Obama administration to approve an application for petroleum drilling was 265 days. The law on the books was 30. Is moving back to what it should have been all the time. So this is just part of it, federal land. Most of the production up from 06 to today has been on private land because of the prohibitive cost, time, and risk in trying to get leases to federal land. So domination means essentially first domestic resources and second the world. But I'll stop here.
That is the voice of Dr. Daniel Fine, Associate Director of the New Mexico Center for Energy Policy, also Senior Policy Analyst at New Mexico State's Department of Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources. You mentioned how much of a major change this is. Would it have been even possible to go forward with this without the fracking revolution, or did you have to have the one to be able to change the other, have to have the fracking to be able to change the policy?
The fracking is part of a complex technology. The base of it today is not so much fracking. Fracking was around for many years. However, the advance in fracking due to computerized capacity for computers to see underground and to drill in the right direction. But the core element now is laterals, horizontal drilling followed fracking. Combined, it was a revolution. A lateral now means a horizontal drilling for oil through hard shale, impenetrable shale. The fracking essentially breaks and cracks the shale to allow the pressure of the injection of hydro water. But the lateral takes 2.5 miles. Think of it as a horizontal drilling technique and a multiple, essentially well frack to penetrate 2.5 miles in a lateral or horizontal well. Means production has changed, and this is part of the technology revolution. Today, it's not so much hydrofracking, although that's advancing. I was in the Bakken in North Dakota last week, and I saw new investment in advanced hydraulic fracking and the new lateral length. That's the key now.
One person who's going to be following this as the issue moves forward is Dr. Daniel Fine, Associate Director of the New Mexico Center for Energy Policy, Senior Policy Analyst for the New Mexico State Department of Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some members of the University of North Carolina's Board of Governors want to increase their campus's focus on college affordability. New board member Tom Fetzer recently explained a resolution he prepared for the full board.
This is a UNC Board of Governors resolution to make college education more affordable. Whereas, median household income in North Carolina increased 17% since 2006, or in roughly the last 10 years. And whereas UNC system tuition increased 91% since 2006, 500% more than the increase in household income, and whereas 61% of UNC system graduates have an average student loan debt exceeding $25,000 each, and whereas the UNC system governed by the Board of Governors is charged by the North Carolina Constitution to provide a college education, quote, as free as practical to the people of North Carolina. Therefore, be it resolved that the UNC Board of Governors will endeavor to reduce tuition and fees at all our member institutions while preserving and enhancing the quality of education provided therein to help make college education more affordable and therefore more accessible to the people we serve.
Board member Joe Knott urged caution as his colleagues addressed Fetzer's resolution.
I'm all for reduced tuition and low tuition as long as we understand that excellence is not cheap. And while we have different tiers and different levels of universities, some of our universities, if they're going to maintain their national and international status and standards, recognize for excellence at the very highest level of academic endeavor. We cannot do that without funds. And I just want to make that. I'm all in favor of keeping tuition as low as it can possibly be, but we can't starve the university in the name of free tuition or whatever and expect our universities to continue or our top-level institutions to continue to be ranked and recognized nationally and internationally.
Board member Tom Goolsbee liked the resolution. He explained one reason why he supports an increased focus on reducing campus tuition.
One big item that I noticed all the chancellors key in on was financial assistance and how needed that is. Well, it darn sure is needed when you double tuition costs on your students over a 10-year period. And as Governor Fetzer said, 500% more than we saw the median income in households go up. I don't know how you justify that during all the economic malaise and everything else we had going on to increase tuition like that.
The UNC Board of Governors ended up endorsing the resolution unanimously. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has seen a number of positive conservative reforms in recent years linked to taxes, government spending, regulatory relief, expanded school choice. One group that is raising awareness about positive reforms is Americans for Prosperity. AFP State Director Donald Bryson joins us now to discuss the latest effort to highlight North Carolina's success story. Donald, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on. I'm always excited to be here with CJ Radio.
We're talking about a particular effort to promote North Carolina's success stories called NC Real Solutions. Tell us what that is.
That's right. Well, this is a project that started back in 2012. Right after the first sort of tax and regulatory reforms happened with what had was at that point the new conservative General Assembly. A lot of things happened at that point. Early on, the project was focusing on how tax reform for small businesses, but particularly also allowing the temporary, and I'm using air quotes, sales tax increase was allowed to sunset and the sales tax went down. But at the same time, we balanced the state budget and provided more funding for state-funded teachers across the state. But since 2012, 2011, we've had four rounds of tax reform passed. We've had regulatory reform bills passed every year except for 2016. We've created three private school choice programs, eliminated the cap on the number of charter schools in the state. A lot of good things have happened in the state of North Carolina. Unfortunately, we have some media presence in the state who won't talk about that. Earlier this year, on January 1st of 2017, as an example, the income tax rate for every North Carolinian went down. But instead, the headlines in the Charlotte Observer were about how the sales tax base was expanded, and it touched on nothing about income tax rates going down. And while the sales tax base did expand, and they're moving to a bit more of a consumption-based tax system, there is a story about North Carolina's economy is booming. We have one of the fastest-growing economies in the nation. We've created more than 360,000 jobs. Our unemployment rate as of Friday, August 18th, the North Carolina Department of Commerce reported our unemployment rate is at 4.1%, which is a far cry from when we had the third highest unemployment rate in the nation at the height of the Great Recession at 11.5%. A good economist would tell you that, you know, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation, but there is a very strong correlation with these tax reforms, regulatory reforms going along with this economic boom we're seeing in North Carolina.
And these are all good pieces of news, and Americans for Prosperity is collecting them and highlighting them in a particular spot. Is that right?
That's right. We are relaunching our NC Real Solutions project. In the past, it has been more of a, you know, we'll run a TV ad sort of a thing, but we're trying to create a higher quality educational process with this. So there is a website now. We revamped the website at ncrealsolutions.com. People can go there, and we're going to roll out different ebooks about tax policy and regulatory policy and education policy and highlight recent reforms that have happened in North Carolina. But along with that, we'll have a comprehensive grassroots approach where we'll be knocking on doors and making phone calls all around the state. But instead of advocating for a policy, we'll be trying to educate people on policies that have already passed. We'll also have town halls all around the state and run a lot of digital ads to promote the website.
We are chatting with Donald Bryson. He is North Carolina State Director for Americans for Prosperity. And Donald, how important is it to get the word out? I mean, we've talked about the fact that there have been a number of interesting and important reforms, but not a whole lot of attention about them within the traditional media. Do you get the sense when you're out knocking on doors, talking to people, that North Carolinians know that these things have happened?
No, I don't get the sense that they know that have happened. People that do know that have happened, as far as just the everyday North Carolinian, are the people that are very politically engaged. They're your precinct chair for the local Republican Party, or they're very involved with the local Tea Party, and they know what has happened at the state level. But what happens with a lot of people is they have what I call Fox News syndrome, where if it's not going on in Washington or somewhere on the international stage, they don't know that it's happened because the 24-hour news cycle doesn't cover state policy. But if you're on the side of people that are fighting for economic freedom, nothing's really happened nationally. Hasn't happened nationally for 9-10 years, even going back into the Bush administration. But at the state level, it's absolutely advancing. And North Carolina is an example of that. But you're seeing that all across the country in other states, where you have budget reform and labor reform in Wisconsin. You have pension reform in Iowa, Kentucky, and Missouri, both in West Virginia, all went right to work. And what does right to work policy mean for those states? Freedom is advancing in the states. The problem is that nobody in those states knows about it.
You mentioned the impact of the media, but another reason why we might not be hearing so much about these things is the fact that this is good news and it's stuff that's happening kind of behind the scenes without a whole lot of conflict once the ideas actually get through the General Assembly and have been debated. You don't see people out there saying, no, I'm mad because my taxes have gone down. No, I'm mad because there are fewer regulations. I mean, these are the types of things that are good news that happen sort of behind the scenes.
That's absolutely true. And it's also a plausibility problem. Is it plausible that the General Assembly raised your taxes or lowered your taxes? Well, it's plausible they probably increased them because they're elected officials and we all hate politicians, right? But on the other side, they actually did cut everybody's taxes. The sales tax rate is lower than it was in 2011. Everybody's income tax rate is lower than it was in 2011, 2013, 2014. The corporate tax rate is lower. It's of states that have a corporate tax rate, which there are some states that are at zero, and I'm envious of those states. But of the states that do have one, North Carolina's is the lowest in the nation, and people don't know that, and they don't know what it means, and nobody is trying to draw the correlation between, hey, these correlate pretty closely with, you know, sort of the economic boom we're seeing in North Carolina. Our job numbers are amazing, and wage growth has increased so much so that in 2016 it was announced that we were going to have another revenue surplus at the state level. And the Department of Commerce at that point said this is largely because of wage growth throughout the state. Oh, my gosh, people are making more money and they're having to pay more taxes. That's good news for the state of North Carolina, but nobody's highlighting that good news, and we're trying to fill that gap in the communication.
Some people will hear us and cynically think, you know, we usually hear all of this stuff around election time. Even if a group is officially nonpartisan, you only hear this stuff around election time. But you're talking about raising awareness here, not in the thick of a campaign fight, but just sort of outside of that normal process.
Absolutely. It's important that people be aware of the public policy process and what not only what is happening and what's being debated, but this is not an advocacy effort. This is an educational effort to talk about policies that have already passed. People just don't know about it. It's not in the thick of a campaign fight. We're not thanking anybody about for any votes or signing any bills or anything like that. It's just, hey, these policies have passed. Here's sort of the economic impact from that. We think it's a positive thing, but it's a message that's not getting out, and we hope, you know, not to be too cliche about it, but we actually think that, you know, tax reform and budget reform and education reform are providing North Carolina's economy with real solutions rather than, you know, trying to prop up the economy with incentives and corporate welfare and other things, which are still problems in North Carolina, but the real economic impact are coming from these good policies that we're highlighting.
You mentioned that name once again, NC Real Solutions. If people want to learn more, where should they go?
They can go to ncrealsolutions.com or ncrealsolutions.org or ncrealsolutions.net. But just keep in mind, NC Real Solutions.
That is the voice of Donald Bryson, North Carolina State Director of Americans for Prosperity. Donald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And this is a project of Americans for Prosperity Foundation.
Okay, very good. We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Our next guest recently wrote an article for the John Locke Foundation under the title, Property Rights Are Cool Again. The specifics dealt with a recent discussion among town leaders in the coastal community of Carolina Beach. The author of that article, Julie Tisdale. She's the John Locke Foundation's City and County Policy Analyst. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mitch.
So first of all, why did this issue from Carolina Beach attract your attention?
Well, this was really exciting to see because I'm always excited when I see a town council, a local government that is doing things that protect property rights and seem to be moving in the right direction. And this was an example of that kind of thing from Carolina Beach. So I was happy to see that they were considering some restrictions and possibly easing those restrictions in Carolina Beach for property owners.
And specifically, the idea was on something called accessory buildings. Before
yes.
we get into the details, tell us what an accessory building is.
An accessory building is a building that you build on your property that's not your house. So it's a shed in the backyard. It's a detached garage. It's those sorts of buildings. It could be anything, but it's not the main house, and it's not attached to the main house. It's a freestanding building that's also on the property. Lots of people have them.
And town council members in Carolina Beach had some concerns that perhaps their rules for accessory buildings were too stringent.
Right. So they had sort of three main rules in place. Three issues, but two main rules. One was about height. So accessory dwellings or accessory buildings can't be more than 15 feet tall. Well, that's fine if you're building a one-story building, but it doesn't allow you to, say, add an apartment over a detached garage, which is something that lots of people like to do, or a workout room, or an office, or any of those things. So there was a height restriction. The other was about footprint. So the accessory building's footprint couldn't be larger than 25% of the footprint of the main dwelling. Now, on a small lot, that's not a big deal. But on a really large lot, that could be an issue. If you wanted to build, you know, quite a large, say, detached garage with some things attached. So people were doing really weird things like building a deck on the back. It doesn't increase the heated space, but it does increase the footprint of the primary dwelling, which allows you to build a bigger accessory building. It was just sort of silly.
And then there was a third issue that was beyond sort of size restrictions, but how these accessory buildings could be used.
Right. So there's a question about whether or not you could rent them out. So if you use it as an office, it's not an issue. But if you're using – if you set up an apartment, can you rent that? Is it – can it only be used as sort of guest space or maybe somewhere for a child to stay and a, you know, adult child? Or could you actually make money off of this and rent it out to people?
So there was plenty of discussion about this at Carolina Beach. What did you find from that discussion and what was your take on it?
So they're sending it back to be considered by the relevant committees. And so there were no final decisions. But the discussion seems positive to me. They think that probably the height restriction of 15 feet is unnecessary. So they're talking about raising that to 25 feet. That was a staff recommendation. They seem favorable to that. That would allow you to build a two-story building. So you can't build something crazy in the backyard. But it would allow most people to do the sorts of things they want to do. They also talked about lifting that footprint restriction. So allowing people to build something that's a little larger and not have to do things like add a deck onto the back of the house. So on both of those points, they said, let's ease these restrictions. Let's make it easier for people to use their property the way they wish. The third point about whether or not to rent out that space is the one that they're sending it back to the relevant committees to really consider in depth. And there are some legitimate concerns there. The main concern is that currently Carolina Beach is approaching capacity on their water and sewer infrastructure. And clearly, if you increase the housing stock, which this might do, then you could have problems. However, they're already looking at having to upgrade their water and sewer systems because they are already close to capacity. They're going to have to expand it in the next few years anyway. So it seems to me that this is a great opportunity to go back and really sort of look at doing a major expansion, build extra capacity beyond what they expect that they'll need right now to accommodate this sort of, you know, increased freedom for property owners.
We are chatting with Julie Tisdale. She is the City and County Policy Analyst for the John Locke Foundation and author of this recent report that you can find at johnlocke.org with the title, Property Rights Are Cool Again. And we've been talking a lot about the specifics here of this debate in Carolina Beach. But generally, one of the things that you point out in your column that it's great to see these town leaders looking at issues of freedom and property rights and not just looking at ways to place new limits on the people who live within the town.
Absolutely. I love that the town was asking sort of the fundamental question about whether this was unduly burdensome on property owners and whether we should actually or could actually lift those restrictions and allow people more freedom to do with their property what they wish. That's a really fundamental principle, and Carolina Beach seems to be respecting it. So that was very encouraging to see. Often we see towns moving in the opposite direction.
Do you see any other towns who are having similar debates about accessory buildings or similar issues?
So this sort of thing is happening right across the state. It is happening in, I wouldn't say every town, but many, many towns. Last year, I was dealing with the exact same issue in Raleigh. There are parts of Raleigh where people have a lot of these accessory dwellings and have been renting them out sometimes, sort of under an Airbnb sort of arrangement. That has been technically illegal, but nobody's enforcing it. People are doing it. And so the city was looking at whether they should regulate that. And there was a lot of debate. So yes, this debate is happening right across the state and indeed across the country. And this is a really important issue. And so I'm glad to see Carolina Beach taking the lead in this way.
As these communities are dealing with these types of issues, are there any bedrock or fundamental principles that you, from your free market perspective, hope that city officials are keeping in mind?
So property rights, you know, people should be able to do what they wish with their own property is a really fundamental one. I think the other really important thing here is that, as I said, there were some real issues around water and sewer. There are other issues that arise that are legitimate. You know, what about noise? What about trash? What about parking? All of those things are fair questions to be asked. But I think it is important that cities and counties are asking if there are other ways to address those issues. Usually there are already noise ordinances, there are already rules that can be enforced about parking. So if we can use the least restrictive sort of means of addressing the actual issue rather than just this blunt instrument of you can't rent out the dwelling space at all. So really targeting the actual issue rather than putting broad restrictions on people's use of their property.
In the brief time that we have left, if other communities are thinking about dealing with these issues, is Carolina Beach setting a good template for them to follow?
So far, I think so. We'll see what they come back with in terms of these regulations around rentals, but certainly in their approach to height and footprint, and just asking questions about whether we can free up property owners, then yes, they're doing the right things.
That is the voice of Julie Tisdale. She is the City and County Policy Analyst for the John Locke Foundation. We've been talking about this recent discussion in Carolina Beach about the use and regulation of accessory buildings. If you'd like to learn more, you can read the column that Julie has written about the topic. Its title, Property Rights Are Cool Again. And you can find it at johnlocke.org. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
That's all the time that we have for this week's program, but please join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio. Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.